Progressive Radio News Hour with Stephen Ledman, Thursdays at 11 a.m. and weekends at 1 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
To the Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. My guest today is Robert Abele. Bob is professor of humanities and philosophy at Diablo Valley College in California. I think regular listeners know him. He's been on a few times before. I'm sure he'll be back. He's written four books, including Democracy Gone and Anatomy of a Deception. That one is about the Iraq invasion, occupation, and preparation for the next deception. Well, there's always a next one. We know that. I mean, the latest big one, of course, is going on in Libya. So there's so much going on at home and abroad, and my God, I just can't keep up with this stuff and all the things that I want to spend time on and address on air in articles and so on. But, Bob, I welcome you back.
Thank you, Steve. Thank you for having me back.
Oh, it's terrific having you on. God, I mean, we could throw a dart at the domestic or overseas board and hit an important topic to discuss. What's uppermost in your mind right now?
Well, the thing that I've been looking at the most and reading about the most, next to Libya, of course, is the Tea Party people and the Republican right wing of government trying to slash Medicare, Medicaid, slash public workers' pensions and benefits and stop the collective bargaining in Wisconsin and Ohio, and seeing what that is all about, and also how the wealthy are faring and who these wealthy are. And I found it very interesting that Joseph Stiglitz, the Nobel Prize winning economist, had an article out this week in Vanity Fair that he called Of the 1%, By the 1%, and For the 1%. And he talks about how this has become extraordinarily serious, this problem of the top 1% controlling more and more of the income and wealth of our economy in the United States. And they now control 40% of the wealth, so according to him. And even economists can't figure out exactly how it's happened and why, but these people have established a global network with one another so that the 1% around the world are now connected in a community where they visit each other and they stay with each other and they contact each other. And it's a growing divide between themselves and what's left of the middle class and the poor class and the rest of the world. And they're still coming up with the reasons for what they do. And it's fundamentally, it's just a lie. I mean, the big thing economically is what they call the marginal productivity theory, you know, that the higher incomes produce greater productivity in a society and they produce better jobs for society. And, of course, we know that that's completely a lie. And then they say that it's really the size of the economy and not who gets what. Of course, that's a lie. Just ask the people who are walking the streets right now. So, and now they're blaming the victims. You hear Scott Walker in Wisconsin talk about how the public sector is draining the economy. The same with Ohio and the governor of Ohio, and they're slashing the benefits for the people who are really the supporting structure for the entire economy while not realizing that if they go down, so do the wealthy. I mean, there's a connection between the two. If the people don't do well, the wealthy can't do well. So I think that that's something that people should start paying very close attention to, and really we need to start getting out in the streets about that. That seems to me to be an even bigger deal than the Libya thing that people are talking about, whether the United States is engaging in more imperialism and all that. That's an important topic, but when the Republicans come to Obama and say, we want $5.8 trillion in cuts in government spending over the next decade, and let's reduce tax rates while we're at it, too, for the wealthy, down to 25%. And Obama basically backs up and says, okay, what do you want? I'll give it to you. We need to be start making a fuss about that, or we're never going to see the end to this.
Oh, absolutely, Bob. I say it all the time on this program. I say it in articles. Anybody expecting change to come from the top down is dreaming. It never happens, not just in America. It doesn't happen anywhere. The only time change comes is when there is real heat put on in the streets. I mean, real angry people absolutely refusing to put up with this crap anymore. And we saw it in Wisconsin, but of course it waned, and that's the problem. Wisconsin had a great opportunity, and they still have it, because the one tool the public has, working people have, is to go on strike. The problem with doing that is they have to realize that the union bosses are allied with the government and allied with the corporate interests. It goes across the board. I was shocked, Bob, when I discovered that way back, you remember the Patco strike in 1982, Reagan?
Sure. Yeah, the beginning of the end of the unions.
Oh, that's right. That was the beginning of the downward cycle to destroying unionism in America. And of course, they went after that was public. They were public workers. Private workers have been mainly decimated. Now the war is going full blast against public workers. But I was shocked back then that AFL-CIO head Lane Kirkland backed the Reagan administration. Against ordinary working people. The head of the AFL-CIO was on the side of Ronald Reagan and not on the side of working people. And that's the other big issue workers need to realize, whether we're talking about public workers or private sector workers. They either have to get rid of these Benedict Arnolds, or they simply have to do it on their own. And I was in contact to an organization that was involved with the Wisconsin workers, and I emailed them a few times, and I said, "You, the one tool you have that you can beat these bandits with is call a general strike. And I know it's tough. You're going to lose income. You're going to suffer, but you're going to suffer a lot more in the long run if you don't take some pain now for greater gain later on. You will really be hurting, because what they're taking out of your hide now is a down payment on what they want ahead. They want it all. They want all your benefits gone. They want you working for near poverty wages. They want you so close to the line that you can't afford to lose half a paycheck, let alone a whole paycheck, so that you're just happy to hang on to anything you have and take whatever crumbs they'll throw at you. But you call a general strike, and they literally could have, the public workers in Wisconsin and across the country can literally shut down the entire state, including the public sector, because if the state isn't operating, nothing operates. That's the tool they have, and I think that's the tool they have to start exercising, and just keep at it and say, these are our demands. They're not unreasonable. We simply want equity and justice, and if you don't give it to us, then we're staying out, and you can all go to hell.
Yeah, I think there's two. I agree completely with you. There's two things that I like to watch for on the horizon of this, too. One of them is that the strike itself is not going to help anything if you don't have collaborations of people in public protest that is covered by the media. So, and that's one of the problems, that the mainstream media just doesn't even talk about these things. Wisconsin did not get that much coverage on mainstream media when the protests were hitting their peak. And all you have to do is dig a little bit to find out why that is. When you find out that all these mainstream corporations that own each other, you know, that Time Warner owns Time Magazine and HBO and Warner Brothers and CNN, all of that, all of the media outlets are run by the people who are like Scott Walker in Wisconsin, and they don't want that word out there. So a general strike is something that is a major tool, but at the same time, if it's not getting the news out there, then you run into a bit of a problem as to how effective that ultimately is going to be in the long run. And there's something else, too, about that ahead of workers planning to do these things, the government has already been in position to bat down forcefully any type of unrest that would occur from general strikes or protests and things of that nature. As I'm sure you're well aware of, the continuity of government planning. The COG, continuity of government, that was started with Rumsfeld and Cheney, and all that.
Oh, absolutely.
Has now blossomed into continuity of operations, where the that started in 2001, even before 9/11, where now the Army has a North Central Command in the United States, and they are in a position to, and they have been drilling to, forcefully put down any type of dissent and protest in the United States by the Army, which raises all the questions about posse comitatus and all of that. But that's certainly there. It's in the Army's own documents that are public documents. The 3rd Infantry Division's 1st Brigade, I think, combat team, went to Iraq in their full battle regalia, patrolling the streets of Iraq, and got training. And then they came back and started doing it in the United States. And that now the U.S. Army has said on their public website that the mission is now a permanent one to control civil unrest and crowd control in the United States. So they're preparing for this type of general strike and this kind of dissent. So the time to do it is now, and there's two things that have to be done. The media has to be on board with this, and you got to keep the Army out. But I don't know that those two things are going to happen, given that both of them are controlled by the same people that brought us this crisis and that are doing very well, thank you very much. So there's a lot of issues here that have to be played out.
Oh, I agree. I agree completely, Bob. And you don't get coverage of this stuff. And, you can have a forest fire if nobody knows about it. The damn thing can burn down, and it'll be like it never happened in the first place. I wonder, I think about the effect. I have never seen a situation where, say, an entire city or an entire state was shut down. It almost seems inconceivable to me that the media would not pick this up. Certainly the local media, I can't imagine how the local media could ignore it. So in Wisconsin, the main paper, I think, is the Milwaukee Sentinel Journal. They were on the Wisconsin story regularly, multiple stories every single day. But I mean that was their issue, and the headquarters of the action was in Madison. Madison is the capital. The capital, and the University of Wisconsin, which was a big part, teachers and students at the University of Wisconsin, very much a part of this. One of them was a guest on my program who comes on another topic, and she was out in the middle of it for a few days, and she teaches at the University of Wisconsin, and she was there. She didn't sleep over, but she was out, and another guest who comes on my program lives about 10 miles away from Madison, and he came out a number of days to see what was going on, but I wonder if you literally shut down a whole city and shut down a whole state, I simply can't imagine at least the local media not being on this. And if that continued long enough, it might be very hard for the national media to ignore it. But if they want to do it, Bob, they will do it make it subside. And I guess the Army could be called out, even if such a strike was nonviolent, and I would think that it would be. The Army is very good at creating violence if they want to. And you start beating up on people, and they just might want to do something to defend themselves, and then, of course, you blame the victim for all this. It's a dirty business, and the odds are very long on success. But in the history of this country, Bob, there have been some marvelous victories, but they weren't won overnight. That's the problem.
Right, they weren't won overnight, and through a lot of very heavy physical abuse and propaganda as well. And I think what I was referring to with the mainstream media is if they do choose to cover it, they'll cover it in such a way that it ends up demonizing the people who are engaged in such processes. So the propaganda machine will be put into place, and their message will be, these are the people who are bringing down this country. It's the same message as right now, but they'll make it even more strong so that the Joe Sixpack on the street who doesn't know what's going on looks askew at the people who are engaged in these strikes. And unless you can capture that, the public sentiment, then you don't have much of a chance of winning. So I guess maybe I'm coming from the pessimistic position right now that the top-down control everything. They know how to demonize those people who are trying to do something. Unless the numbers are huge And unless they do something like you're talking about, shut down state after state, not just one, but state after state, I don't see a lot on the horizon to be very optimistic about in terms of turning the economic situation that we're in around. The wealthier get wealthier, and as they get more wealthy, they're a lot less interested in paying their fair share for common things like parks and transportation, because they can buy their own way around. They can buy their own elevators up to their offices. They can buy their own little parks and put them in their backyard, you know, expand their property. I don't see any movement to turn that over. And there's certainly nothing going on in terms of prosecuting people on Wall Street who are engaged in all kinds of just freelance theft. They're not doing anything about that. Obama hasn't done a thing about the prosecutions of these people. Matt Taibbi of Rolling Stone magazine, I think it was back at the beginning of March, wrote an article naming names. Here's this person. Here's all the illegalities they've engaged in. Here's their connection to the Obama administration. And this rotating, revolving door just keeps going on and on. So there's two classes that are squared off. The one class is extremely disadvantaged, the class of the workers, the public school sector, the public workers, and then the big guys with the big guns and the big megaphones. And I don't see how the little guys are going to stand much of a chance at this particular point unless there is a groundswell movement that's never come about. It has never happened. And people, liberals used to sit back and say, oh, when people start hurting, they'll get together. People are hurting very badly now, and they're not getting together. So I'm not seeing a whole lot of movement. I'm not seeing a whole lot of optimism for anything in the future. So you change my mind, Steve. Go ahead.
I agree with you, Bob. I mean this is playing. This is like playing on a rigged roulette wheel where the game is rigged against you, and you have to figure out a way to kick that damn wheel and make it at least operate the way it should. The odds are extremely long. And look at what just happened. Obama agreed. I wrote an article 2 days ago. Was it yesterday? I put out so many, I forget what day. 2 days ago, when he capitulated again to the Republicans, I cited at the beginning of my article that last December he capitulated on extending the Bush tax cuts to the rich after he was so vehement that he absolutely wouldn't go along with this. Well, of course, he's a liar. He's broken all his major pledges. Absolutely, it's a flawless record. So he capitulated on that last December, and then weasel worded his way around it, and he did it again on a Friday, agreeing to the Republican demands for austerity cuts, and it's only round one, $38 billion. It's mostly social benefits. They weren't enumerated. We can only guess what they are, but they weren't enumerated, but you can bet virtually all of them are related to social benefits one way or another. So ordinary people are taking the pain, but never in those so-called negotiations, and I don't think there were any negotiations, there was a lot of on TV, etc., public posturing, playing to the home crowd, the constituencies, so the Democrats want their voters to think, well, we're really standing up for your issues, and, we'll only do what we don't want to do to avoid something worse. You know, a government shutdown would be something worse. The hell it would be something worse. Shut the damn thing down. I mean, when it ill-serves people, shut it down and keep it down. I mean, I want a different government replacing the one that we have now, one that actually serves the people, not the bankers and the other corporate favorites and the rest of them. But the media went along with this thing like, oh, this was really a wonderful thing. We saved the shutdown, and we agreed to $38 billion in cuts. And if anything, I mean, it wasn't enough. We should have cut a lot more, ignoring the fact that it is a down payment for a hell of a lot more coming. But at the same time, Bob, there was no discussion on the media, on whatever discussion Republicans and Democrats had about the bloated defense budget, the imperial foreign wars that we aren't spending $700 billion, the latest defense appropriation, if it passes, I'm sure it will. Oh, no, it did pass. It passed unanimously last December. But the real budget is at least double that with all the hidden stuff and intelligence and the rest of it and interest on the debt. It's something like $1.5 trillion fighting imperial wars that does absolutely no good for anybody in the country except the profiteers, and absolutely nothing said about all of the trillions, not billions, not hundreds of billions, but trillions of dollars we handed over to bankers who stole money in the first place, caused the economic crisis, threw all these people out of jobs, out of homes, out of futures, and we reward them for their crimes with trillions of taxpayer dollars. And when we say we're broke and we have to impose austerity measures, those aren't the people we go after. We go after ordinary people already hurting. Of course, not a word in the media about this, nor will there ever be.
No, and there's a couple of other things about that as well. Obama has actually doubled up on some of the federal resources to catch some of the wrongdoers, but the wrongdoers are of a different type. Last year, the Obama administration deported almost 500,000 immigrants, costing us $5 billion of taxpayer money. And the federal felony prosecutions along the Mexican-Texas border, they've gone up 77% under Obama. And non-felony prosecutions are up 250%, I think it's actually higher than that, 250% under Obama. That's where he's putting his law enforcement money. In the meantime, on his own cabinet, Goldman Sachs was his largest private campaign contributor. He put a Citigroup executive in charge of his economic transition team. He just named the J.P. Morgan Chase executive, who owns like $7.5 million of Chase stock, his new chief of staff. This is the guy who said, change is what I want, and change is what we can believe in, and here's the end result. Let's round up Mexicans and deport them. Let's pick on the poor and put $5 billion toward that. And in the meantime, let me bring on board all of these big wheel corporate goons who have stolen money from the taxpayers and from their own corporations. Let me bring them onto my staff. That'll really help the economy a lot. That'll help us a whole lot. I understand that he wants to win elections and he's got to have these guys. That's the biggest problem. He's got to have these guys on his side to win elections. But the problem is he has completely turned his back on everybody else, and nobody else is getting even a spoonful of assistance from him, not even in word. I mean, look at how much he begged off on the Wisconsin situation with the public school teachers, and he said, the only thing I remember hearing him say is, well, you know, the Scott Walker's plan isn't helpful. Well, now there's real solid support from the president who wants change.
Oh, for sure, Bob. And he's made other comments about shared sacrifice. Shared sacrifice. I don't see the bankers sacrificing anything. I don't see the war profiteers sacrificing anything. It's all the sacrificing done by ordinary people who are hurting so badly now. Yeah, Obama is, I didn't expect much from him, because during the campaign I wrote about him, and I covered his voting record in the Senate. And if you forgot Democrat and you forgot the name of the presidential candidate, and just looked at the voting record, I mean, he voted like a Republican. He supported all the corporate interests. He wasn't around when the Patriot Act was enacted. He came out of the Illinois Senate, and I think it was 2004 that he was elected to the U.S. Senate. So less than a full term in the U.S. Senate, and there he is sitting in the Oval Office. He was groomed way, way back. He was spotted as a comer, I think, back in law school, and it was like you have a potential winner supporting the big elitist interest sitting on your bench, but we need to bring him out at the right time, just like maybe a great pinch hitter in baseball or something. You don't want to use him in the second inning. You want to use him at a strategic moment of the game where he can get a big hit and win the ball game for you. Well, George Bush was the choice of the elitist back in 2000, and even though he lost the election and lost the 2004 election, it didn't matter. When the game goes against them, they just change the game. So they installed him as president twice, but he was so in-your-face offensive, whether on imperial wars and so much else. I mean, there was a lot of fraud going on during his years, and there were scandals, Enron and WorldCom and a whole bunch of others I remember writing about. And his approval ratings got to be rock bottom. So Republicans had a go. It was time for a change. It reminded me of 1976, Bob, when Nixon, of course, was so discredited, and Jerry Ford just kind of sat in his seat for a few years, and the Rockefellers chose this unknown Georgia governor to run for president. Little did we know, they didn't choose him to run for president. They chose him to be president. So, Jimmy... That's the way our lovely system works. We pretend we have elections, Bob, but it's really all theater to install the people that the elitists want. And think of the choice we have. We don't get to even pick the candidates. The party bosses, the corporate bosses pick the candidates, and then we get to choose from column A or B, which is really only column A. It's
right, column A and A1, yeah.
I mean, do you want chop suey or do you want chop suey? I mean, that's
chop suey with cinnamon on it or something. Yeah.
I mean, there's literally no choice. So we had a seamless transition from George Bush to a guy in a party with a different name, a person with a different name, but it really is the same thing, except he's worse than Bush because too many people believe in him and still do, and he's a lot smoother than Bush. He's not in your face. He's quieter. He's softer. He gets people to believe that black is white and white is black, that these imperial wars are really good things. You know, I mean, being in Afghanistan, I mean, we're fighting these terror. We don't want the Taliban coming into Chicago or New York, do we? I'm not sure they know where Chicago or New York is, let alone having any interest in coming here. And Libya, humanitarian intervention, those words are not in the vocabulary of Imperial America, nor have they ever been, nor are they in the vocabulary of any country that goes to war against any other one. I mean, it's ludicrous to think that we wage a war for humanitarian reasons. I mean, the reasons are so obvious, but most people, they watch CNN, they watch Fox, they believe this crap. They get the millions of viewers, and this program, if I'm lucky, gets thousands. If this program had millions of listeners all the time, and it was on regularly, around the clock, 7 days a week, they wouldn't get away with this stuff, Bob. But unfortunately, we don't have anybody bankrolling us to that extent.
Actually, you wouldn't get away with that, Steve.
You would. I remember William Blum, who wrote Rogue State, and he fantasized, I think in an article that he once wrote, about being president. And what he would, on day one, he would do this. And on day two, he would do this. And on day three, I think he lasted three days. On day three, he would do this. And on day four, he'd be assassinated.
Might be worth the risk if you can get somebody in there. That's one of the problems, you know. That the whole idea of trying to get someone who really has different ideas and who really would represent change, they have to pass through corporate litmus tests before they get anywhere. And because they can't, those people are just screened out from politics. And we talked about this last time that you and I discussed on air some of these things. I've seen it locally with California. If you are not in the corporate favor, you're just out. You can't even get in the building. Literally, you can't even get in the building. And you can see that from not just the local level, but all the way up to the national level, where you have, back to the Wall Street thing, because that's what I've been kind of doing my reading in, the Justice Department saying they're not going to take any action against laymen. And if you read through why that is, even though they don't say why, there's that ongoing revolving door where if you're going to be accepted politically, you have to be accepted by Lehman Brothers and the big corporations on Wall Street. And if there's no prosecution going on because everybody wants to keep that door turning so that they can go from government like the SEC, they can go over to Lehman Brothers and then go back to the SEC and vice versa, you've got one party who controls everything and who will only put their own representatives up for an office. So that's why I'm so pessimistic about the possibility of change, because the only way that that change can come about in the face of things like the Lehman Brothers Justice Department revolving door, the only way the change is going to break that down is from a groundswell of people who take things back into their own hands. Like the Mexican people who were protesting, what was the number, 10 million people protested this week? Get people out on the street and those kind of numbers in the United States today. Then you've got something to hang on to. Then you've got real hope for change. Prior to that, that's not going to happen. And all of the cards are in place. the rich have gotten their way, the super elite. They're not just rich, they're super elite rich. They're making 10 times what people who were rich were making in the 1980s and calling themselves rich. They're the ones that are in charge, and they're not backing away. And the more that anything comes at them that threatens their stranglehold on economy, the more they paint themselves as victims, and their victims as the prosecutors and the perpetrators of some type of gross injustice. They just don't get it. But we're not telling them the message, which is also why if you continue to try to tell them the message and you started to grow, they'd find a way to get rid of you. So it's all, the liberals and the progressives have become just a small little whispering voice and whispering to each other about all of this, but they're not out there in the streets because there's nobody to join them out in the streets.
Absolutely.
I'm not exactly sure why that is. Economists can't explain why that is. When everybody is hurting, nobody's taking positions out in the street. The unions are gone. Their total enrollment is down like somewhere around 12%, and nobody is saying anything. So what do you do?
It's astonishing, Bob, and it could be that maybe the feeling of hurting people is that there's a little bit of isolation, and they want to do something, and they want a better life, and what can they do? You know, I hear the comment often, I'm just one person, what can I do? Well, I mean, there's an awful lot of people that feel the same as you do, and the idea is to coalesce and do something together, but I think we're well past the time of just getting out in the street and protesting and making speeches and so on. I honest to God think we need a revolution. I'm not talking about a violent revolution, but I'm talking about a revolution that will accept nothing less than absolute, complete change. And I think our system is so broken, so corrupted, it is beyond fixing. And I literally, my choice is literally to rip the thing down to the ground and start all over again, including a new constitution. Now, that's the thought to pick up on after a brief break.
Yeah,
I mean, that's what I want to see done. In my dreams, in my dreams, that's what I want. Let's take a short break, Bob, and come right back.
Okay.
Adam Coulter with Brooklyn Jazz Underground Radio. We'll be here every Tuesday from 5 to 6 with great music, interviews, and live performances right here on PRN, the Progressive Radio Network. Again, that's Tuesdays from 5 to 6, or you can listen anytime at the archives at progressiveradionetwork.com.
South of the border.
Are you one of the millions caught up in that first world rat race? Well, I used to be. I'm John Mueller, host of the Expat Files, where we discuss what it's really like to live, work, play, and or retire down in Latin America. Can you really live like a king down here on a crummy Social Security check? What about starting a business or buying a house or love and romance? Just tune in Monday and Wednesday at 8 p.m. and send me an email, theexpatfiles@gmail.com. And to listen to any of my past shows, just go to progressiveradionetwork.com/archives and click on the link to the Expat Files. Nos vemos.
I kiss the smile upon her face.
Every Sunday at 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, join the founders of the Godspeed Institute for Spiritual Learning, Carol and Michael Hallenbeck, for Godspeed, an enlightening and informative journey into the world's religions and spiritual belief systems. Through conversations with experts worldwide, this weekly live call-in program is an on-air classroom aimed at helping listeners gain exposure to and insight into religious and spiritual practices around the world, every Sunday, 2 to 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Thank you.
Bob Abele. Oh, my God. To the barricades, Bob. Revolution. My goodness gracious, what is this guy Steve Lindman talking about?
Yeah, I'm...
Go ahead.
Go ahead. I'm with you on that.
Let me add one other comment.
Yeah.
I think the lesson of Jack Kennedy has never been forgotten by succeeding presidents, that here's a guy that clearly was the victim of a state assassination. The nonsense of a lone gunman and all the rest is absolute malarkey, just like the 9/11 malarkey. I mean, Kennedy was taken out, and I think there were a lot of reasons, but my guess on the main one was that he wanted to pull the troops out. He first sent troops into Vietnam, not a great many, but he first escalated early on when he came into the White House. But then he wanted to pull the troops out and end the war, get our involvement out of that place. And I guess the smart folks around him, he had his advisors, told him that, this is a losing proposition. We have nothing to gain by waging a war in Vietnam. I mean, whoever came up with this crazy idea, I mean, get the heck out of there. And he also rejected the idea of a second Bay of Pigs against Cuba. And I think he got a lot of right-wingers very angry about both. And if you wanted to pick maybe the two main reasons, and there were others, but the two main, he hated the CIA. That was another one. I don't know that he had a plan to get rid of it, but he sure wished he could get rid of it. Even back in 1960, my God, CIA was almost a kid, a teenager back in those days, and but still enough to intimidate presidents. And now, my God, they're a power all to themselves. You go against the CIA, you're signing a death sentence against yourself. But I think that lesson has never been forgotten. So if we ever have a new president that tries to act like Kennedy, he knows that he may get stuff done, but he will have a very short lifespan because the power structure will not put up with him.
Well, that's where I started to talk after the break, that I'm with you on that need for some type of significant overturning of the current power structure that we were talking about during the first part of the show today. I think that a couple of things about that, aside from the Kennedy thing, who also sicked his brother after the mafia, by the way, as you
oh,
know.
Yeah.
But
oh, yeah.
the, that also has something to do with it, that the CIA mafia connection is pretty strong, too. But anyway, the...
We know what happened to his brother, also.
Oh, right, both of his brothers, actually, yeah. But the... one brother brought it on himself, I guess. But the revolutions that we're seeing now in the Middle East connect with this. The United States and their that whole system of economic greed and the top percent taking all the resources and all the money. The rebellions in the Middle East are against United States-supported governments, by and large. And what we're going to see there is, as those as a tumult in the Middle East spreads and grows, Obama can't bomb everybody like he's starting with Libya, but if you see what's happening with oil and the connection of oil there, as most people clearly do, the world is growing in its demand for affordable oil. And the Middle East alone supplies 37% of the world's oil. So Western governments only support, the United States in particular, I guess, only support those quote-unquote stable governments that allow us to have the control of that oil. When they become quote-unquote unstable, that is, they are not going to be doing the bidding of Washington, when Washington says go right and they go left, that's when we need to bomb them. And we'll use any pretext to be able to do that. The end result from that, though, that I want to get to is that we were talking about the revolution, the need for revolution. If we look at those revolutions that are going on in the Middle East, the cause of those revolutions are years of oppression by the dictators who were in large measure held up by the United States. So the United States is in a very difficult position when the people are opposing their very dictators. When we start seeing $5 a gallon gas, you may see some type of movement like that in the United States. Because if you look at what happened in Iran and Iraq with the connection of their oil and the Western world, the 1979 revolution in Iran to get the United States out, these revolutions now are kind of mimicking that. There's a lot of unrest in Iraq about the oil and the situation there. That is what might spread over here. And I think that's part of the concern of the army and this notion that we're going to declare martial law if the upper elites don't get their way, which is what it was Hank Paulson. Hank Paulson said that to two senators. If you don't give us our bailout, we're going to declare martial law and bring the army on the streets here. I think they're practicing for that, and I think that this collapse of the world oil order that we have seen it since World War II, as that begins to collapse in the Middle East, the tsunami wave from that will come over this way. That's where you might start seeing some type of change occur in the United States, when people begin to realize that they're under the same boot that we've been putting on the people of the Middle East. When they make that connection, then you might start seeing some type of movement. I don't see that really happening yet. When you have well-known progressives like Juan Cole, who wrote what he called an open letter to the left on Libya and laid out something like 11 different points on why this is really a humanitarian intervention and Obama is to be lauded for his humanitarian intervention, and you turn on shows like Bill Maher's Real Time, it's my favorite program on HBO, and he brings on his guests and they're all saying, yes, this is a real humanitarian intervention. I'm not sure that there isn't that element to it, but I certainly don't think that when we look at what would constitute a legitimate humanitarian intervention, we don't have any goals in there. We just went in and started bombing. We don't know how long we're going to be there. We really don't know if there's really going to be boots on the ground, but if you're really going to tame Gaddafi, you're going to have to put boots on the ground. It would seem that the size of that attack would be originally to rescue the failed rebellion, but it's more likely the case that we're going to keep fighting and hope that the rebels get rid of Gaddafi. We're only going to be able to do that is if we keep pushing that. We don't have any Arab support. We just went in. NATO just went in. You didn't get Qatar's support. You didn't get the United Arab Emirates support. We just kind of went in. And there was a lot of opposition in the UN, too. Russia, China, India, Brazil, Germany, all opposed it. The Arab League said they called for no-fly zone, and they backed off of that. And so the overthrow of a government is not necessarily a humanitarian intervention. So I don't know. I kind of got lost where I was going there. So jump in there, Steve.
Oh, well, I agree. And the idea that the uprisings in the Middle East, they are so interesting to me, Bob. I don't call any of them revolutions. Revolutions are really very distinctive and very violent. I mean, revolutions, my God, we had one in America. Not exactly a garden variety revolution, but that's another story. But the Russian Revolution, that was extremely violent and in two phases. And there have been revolutions. There was one in France in the 18th century. And, I mean, revolutions, I mean, they really are a special breed. So I call them uprisings, but the situation in Libya is unique in the region, and it's an insurgency, in my opinion. And this thing was planned months before we began hearing anything about it. These so-called rebels, there are really several elements that make them up. There are a lot of people in Libya that do not like Gaddafi. And I remember in one of my articles that I wrote about Gaddafi, there's no question that he's a despot, but he is a despot who rewards his friends and he punishes his enemies. So there is a substantial amount of the Libyan population, it may even be a majority, that support Gaddafi because he gave them free education and free health care and raised their standard of living. They have jobs. They have things that people in other Arab countries do not have. So an entirely different situation in Libya, and these so-called rebels are, you've got legitimate opposition that I guess is in the camp that comprise Gaddafi's enemies, not people he supports, and people who'd love to get rid of him. I think most of them are not part of a fighting force with guns and taking an active part in this insurrection. The ones that really have, well, another element are these so-called defectors. And I'm not certain just what's going on with them. My feeling is that they were either bribed and or intimidated to come over to the other side or else. Maybe these are people who have had contacts with Western countries, and they talk to each other, a foreign minister or somebody like that. Obviously, they have a lot of contacts, and the deal was spelled out to them that we're taking Gaddafi out, and you have a choice. You can be taken out with him, or you can come over to our side, and we'll be a lot nicer to you than we will if you decide to stay the course and support this guy who's coming out. And I have no doubt that the plan is to get rid of him, ideally kill him. I think the Pentagon knew from the start that it was impossible to win an air war, and I think the military experts concur in that. So there are one or two things that will happen. There'll either be a certain ground invasion with no authorization whatsoever to do it. We don't care about authorizations. We do what we want anyway. And America is running everything. The so-called handover was fake. I refer to the Pentagon as a code word. I'm sorry, I refer to NATO as a code word for the Pentagon. The AFRICOM U.S. commander stationed in Stuttgart, Germany, because no African country wants him, this General Carter Ham, he is running everything, and of course he has a boss, and that goes right up to the top ranks of the Pentagon. They are running the show, and American warships are still participating in this show, maybe a little less than the opening week or 10 days or whatever, but American warplanes are still flying missions and firing missiles and dropping bombs and the rest of it, and this idea that we pull out is nonsense. These so-called insurgent rebels, the violent ones, the ones that we don't name by name, but who these people are, and this is the core of the insurgency, these are the same people who were our allies, either the same people or latter-day ones who were our allies in Afghanistan, the Mujahideen, who became our enemies in Iraq. They were killing Americans, and now they're our allies again, and they're comprised probably of native Libyans. And in Iraq, the insurgency against us was mainly from Saudi Arabia, but there were a lot of Libyans there as well, and also Arabs from other countries. But Saudi Arabia and Libya comprised the main ones from the information that I was able to get. That's probably true. So very likely these are similar people in Libya now fighting Gaddafi. CIA, British intelligence, U.S. Special Forces, British commando special forces, Egyptian commandos have been in Libya for many weeks, maybe many months. And I believe this whole operation was planned and on the shelf, ready for implementation, going back sometime last year. My guess would be at least 6 months before anything happened, just like the Afghan War. The Afghan War was planned at least 6 months before 9/11. The Iraq War in 2003. Oh, that might have been planned 6 years before we did it. I mean, the plan is there. It's on the shelf. We take it off whenever we want to implement it. And the plan to get rid of Gaddafi, I think, was around for a while, even though he came in from the cold in 2003. He admitted to the Lockerbie bombing. He had absolutely nothing to do with it, and everybody knew it. And the guy who was convicted, this innocent guy, who they finally let out of prison, I mean, he never should have been in prison in the first place. And the convicting court knew that he was innocent, but they were bullied by the West to go along. The story is so dirty. I am no Gaddafi supporter. But compared to other despots, he stands out. Is if I had to be ruled by a despot, and I had to choose among the ones in the Middle East, I absolutely would choose him over all the rest, the Saudis and the Bahrainis and the Syrians and and the Algerians. I mean these are real mean and nasty people. And as long as you don't cross Gaddafi, just like Saddam, you could get along very nicely and get all the benefits that he handed out, using his oil revenue and so on. But I think his sin was he wasn't 100% puppet, Bob. America wants a puppet who's 100%. No ifs, ands, or buts. What America says goes. We're the boss. And as long as the puppet goes along, we don't care how many people he kills and oppresses or anything else he does at home. As long as when we give the orders, he salutes, he's our guy. If he only salutes 90% of the time, sorry, that's not good enough. Out he goes for another useful idiot to take his place who salute 100% of the time, and I think that was Gaddafi's sin.
I think you're probably right about that. I mean, you trace the United States history regarding their intervention in foreign lands, particularly in the Middle East. That's really what it was. You take Washington's marching orders or you're out one way or the other. And one of the things that occurs to me as you were talking about that is that if the United States had clearly been interested in something humanitarian as opposed to bombing, and incidentally, parenthetically on this, you don't bomb Gaddafi's palace if you're not after Gaddafi. So, I mean, this whole idea that we're doing a humanitarian intervention and bombing his palace while we're doing it, that kind of shows the lie to all that right there. But anyway, if you're really interested in a humanitarian intervention, the World Banks had already frozen the assets from Libya and Gaddafi's cabinet and his sons and everything. They could have turned those assets over to the Revolutionary Council and let them arm themselves if they really wanted to do this peacefully. They didn't have to go in with bombs. It's just that they want to get Gaddafi out and get him out quietly, and I mean quickly, not quietly, and put their own person in there as quickly as possible. That's where the bombs come in. It doesn't really have a lot to do with humanitarian intervention. But that said, I look at Juan Cole's argument, and I'm curious about have you read his argument by any chance or heard it?
I know he wrote it, but I didn't read it. I was so furious when I knew he wrote something like that. The first thought in my mind, Bob, when I see something like that is, who bought him off? How much did he get paid for doing this? I mean, he really can't believe the garbage that I understand he wrote. What were his main arguments?
He's got 11 of them, but I'll just give you a couple of the ones that stand out to me as something just to look at. I've got his open letter right here because I was looking it over last week sometime because I wanted to hear what he had to say because he really does have an expertise in the Mideast. So here's what he says. The idea that I'm not reading this. I'm just kind of paraphrasing what he's done. The idea that there's only Benghazi that rose up, he tries to say that that's not true because he said if you look across Libya, and he names all these cities, one after the other, including some of the working class in Tripoli, that have been rising up in protest. It wasn't just the eastern part of Libya. And so this idea that it was just confined to the uprising was confined to a small group in a particular area, like Jeremy Scahill said, his sources said that the rebels were only about 1,000 people, really. But Juan Cole says there's really millions of people, including 500,000 people in Misrata and 700,000 people of Benghazi who were all part of this protest to try to get rid of Gaddafi and push him out. And another argument that he makes is that those on the left that are opposed to intervention are in fact acquiescing in Gaddafi's destruction of these other people, Libya's workers, they're poor, the middle class, and all of that. So, in other words, he's kind of taking this bifurcated idea. You either support the intervention to get rid of Gaddafi's attacks on civilians, or, in fact, you're supporting that type of attack. The rest of this, a lot of the stuff he puts in there, is a lot of it's non sequitur stuff, but this idea of that it's an imperialistic thing, I don't even get what he's trying to say. So, but anyway, those are the arguments that he's put up that I think are something worth looking at. If there are really that many people that have been opposing Gaddafi and we just haven't been made aware of that, there might be something to that to say, okay, well, you know, you've got a legitimate uprising going on in Libya, so why not give them a hand? Again, the other side is there's a lot of ways to give them a hand without sending in your own jets and bombing them. So I just like to bounce that off you because, in all honesty, my mind is not totally made up about the imperialist idea. I think I lean that way. But when I read some of the things like this, I think, well, if there's actually this type of uprising and they're getting slaughtered in the process, why not help them out?
Well, number one, Bob, the slaughter did not begin until the uprising, and I think it was incited and funded, and I believe also maybe armed to a limited extent by the West, by France, by America, by Britain. America also using the Saudis and Egyptians to get arms in. So the so-called slaughter by Gaddafi. He didn't begin it. It was begun against him, and he responded I mean, literally, he's a guy, a despot, a Democrat, doesn't matter. An insurrection happened in his country, and if I were the leader of Libya and an insurrection broke out, I sure would do everything I could to put it down. I would prefer to do it nonviolently, but if violence was inflicted against me and people who I want to protect, then I would fight fire with fire. So I'm not defending Gaddafi, but I think that's the way it happened. I disagree with Juan Cole. I'm certainly no expert on the region or Libya, but all the stuff that I've read, I'll go along with Jeremy Scahill, that I think a great number of people in Libya, and my guess is half or more of the country, either supported Gaddafi or tolerated him and did not want any of this to happen and absolutely never became part of this insurgency to get rid of him. Now, they're sitting there as sitting ducks. You know, the bombs are falling and missiles are flying and so on, and it's their country. I mean, just imagine that happening here in America or anywhere in the West that doesn't see this kind of stuff. I mean, they're very upset. And I think this is all caused by the West, and because of I believe imperial interests. And Juan Cole, I think, can surprise sometimes, and not a way that makes me very happy. He knows the region, but I don't know what his motives are for saying this thing. So I wonder, does he really believe this, or is he? Does he have other fish to fry? And if he comes down too hard on the other side, maybe he will end up a loser in his personal life for whatever benefits that he gets. And maybe that's why he did something like this. I mean, there are an awful lot of academics and people in other walks of life who represent the things that you and I absolutely are against, Bob, because they benefit so greatly from it. And if they come down on the other side, I mean, just in the media, if I wanted to take the opposite stand from what I do, I'm not really a media person. I began this at age 70. So this was never my profession, but doing what I'm doing makes it impossible. If I wanted a career on television or with the New York Times or Time Magazine or whatever, it would be impossible doing what I'm doing. So if I want that paycheck, and for some people it can be pretty decent, I would have to play the ball game their way. I could not play the ball game my way, and that's a ball game, thankfully, I don't have to play because I don't want to play it. So I had one working life, and now I can spend this one as a volunteer doing what I want to do, free and clear, independent, not taking 10 cents from anybody, doing what I want. And I really see ill motives going on in Libya. There are horrors going on in countries like Bahrain. I had an interview this morning on Press TV that lets me say things impossible to say in the U.S. media, and the topic was Bahrain. And they had a human rights advocate in Bahrain talking about the stuff going on. I mean, there are horror stories going on in Bahrain, and America's Fifth Fleet is there, Bob. And I think America is absolutely backing the Bahraini government to kill its own people, to torture its own people, to get the Saudis to come in and invade the country and do the same thing. And do we hear any reports in our media about this stuff going on? I'm not certain there are any reports about Bahrain, but it's at least as bad in Bahrain, incited by the wrong forces against the Bahraini people, and that's okay with Obama. He's not saying we need a no-fly zone and we need humanitarian intervention. The only place he said that at was in Libya. Well, we've got uprisings all across the Middle East in a dozen or more countries. You mean we shouldn't intervene humanitarianly in any other country? Well, I'm not all that favor of intervening in the internal affairs of any country, Bob. But the only country we picked on was Libya. There's got to be an ulterior motive.
Well, that or, as Juan Cole suggests in his arguments about this, that any military invention has to be selective. You got to pick the area that you want to intervene. You're absolutely right. The United States can't intervene in each and every country that has protests going on and in which they've got to respond in some particular way, or the government responds in a particular way. Can't go into each and every one of those countries. So the question that you rightfully raise is, why Libya? My answers to that are not really readily available. I don't have a way to answer that question. I can see arguments on each side, this idea that it's for humanitarian purposes or that it's for imperialism. One way or the other, I suppose all this will tease out over time, but I don't really go one way or the other with this. The evidence isn't there for me.
Well, humanitarian reasons certainly are not there for me, Bob. And I can't think of anything going back as far in my memory goes that we ever did anything for humanitarian reasons. I mean, we have no interest in humanity at home. Why on earth would we have it in Libya? We are out of time. My God, the damn hour went by. Oh, I wish we had a second hour, Bob. I'm going to shoot you an email. Oh, this was a marvelous, marvelous hour, a marvelous discussion. You're a great guest, and I love having you on, and I sure want to get you back.
Well, thanks, Steve. I really enjoyed talking to you. I hope we can talk again on the air soon.
Oh, I indeed hope so. I'll shoot you an email about it. Thanks, Bob.
Okay, sounds good. Thanks.
And join us, of course, every week, Thursdays, 11 a.m. Eastern Time, weekends, 1 p.m. And you'll hear stories, real topics, great guests like Bob, things you need to know. That's why I always say make it a regular habit.